On October 5th, 2020, the Northern Plains Resource Council hosted a conversation with ecologist, author, activist Bill McKibben via Zoom. He spoke about the state of play in which we find ourselves when it comes to climate change and the future we can create together, including local solutions already in motion here in Montana.
Thank you for joining us. My name is Emma Kirk-Harpender, and I'll be your host for the evening. Welcome to Turning the Corner on Climate Change, a conversation with Bill McKibben, hosted by Northern Plains Resource Council. I'm from Billings, Montana, and have been a member of Northern Plains for the last 5 years. Northern Plains is a community-based organization headquartered in Billings. Montana ranch families formed Northern Plains in 1972 to fight back when big coal companies started moving into our state. We are everyday Montanans from across the state who love where we live, and we stand up shoulder to shoulder to protect this place we call home. We are looking toward a future where we can transition to clean energy, where we protect our water, our land, and our ability to produce food locally, where the people, us, take part in decisions being made about our natural resources, our future, and our lives. Time is of the essence to create this future, and we must act now. This is why we wanted Bill McKibben to come and speak about the future we can create at this moment of climate crisis. Bill McKibben is a founder of the grassroots climate campaign 350.org and the Schumann Distinguished Professor in Residence at Middlebury College in Vermont. He was a 2014 recipient of the Right Livelihood Prize, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel, and the Gandhi Peace Award, and has been awarded honorary degrees from 19 colleges and universities. He's written over a dozen books about the environment, including his first, The End of Nature, published 30 years ago, and his most recent, Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? Bill McKibben is one of the leading American voices on climate change and has organized for climate action on every continent. We've tried for a long time to bring Bill McKibben to Northern Plains. After seeing him appear on 60 Minutes last spring, we decided that this is an important time to try again. He said in his interview then, "Here we are where Robert Frost lived for the last 40 years of his life, in the woods of Vermont. Maybe his most famous poem is about the two roads diverging in the wood." Then Bill said, "Maybe it's time to think about taking the one less traveled." I am delighted to introduce Bill McKibben tonight.
Emma, what a pleasure to be with you, and thank you very much for welcoming me. Greetings from the Northern Forest here in Vermont, where we've actually, over the weekend, we were at the absolute peak of our autumn color, and now the leaves have begun to fall, and in a few days, winter will be staring us down. It's my favorite time of year as we're headed into the darker months, and it's such a pleasure to get to join you all. First of all, let me apologize for sitting here with a cast on my arm. You might be okay to ask yourself, why should I listen to anyone who went over the handles of his bicycle? It's a fair question. All I can tell you is I was being good and low carbon, but the road was being good and high impact. Everybody wear your helmet as well as your mask, because it really helps. It's a real pleasure to get to join you, even if the thing that we have to talk about tonight is not a hell of a lot of fun. And I say that especially because I'm so grateful for the work you've done in your part of the world, which is one of my favorite places on earth. I love Montana and the country around it. I love it enormously. And I've spent an awful lot of happy time out there, even though my own preferred landscape in the end are the fuzzy mountains of the Northeast and this birch and beech and maple forest. I have a great love too for the wide open places where you all roam, and I'm so grateful for the work you've done to protect them. And what I want to talk about tonight is the protection that we have to do in a world, well, where we're not really in where what we do locally can't determine the outcome of what's going to happen globally, where we have to figure out how to work together as a country and a planet, even though it's incredibly important to also be doing the right things close to home. Now, I wrote the first book about climate change. It came out 31 years ago, I guess now, in 1989, which means I wrote it when I was 28. And truth is, I in fact was just looking back over it the last few weeks because The New Yorker is publishing a big anthology of their writings on climate change, and it begins with The End of Nature, which was published in The New Yorker as well as a book. The truth is, we basically knew most of the story all the way back then. You know, in those days, I could have fit every scientific article and monograph and paper on the top of my desk, and I pretty much did. And now you could fill an airplane hangar four times over with work that's been published on climate change. But the outlines, indeed, most of the details haven't really changed in that period. If there was one thing that people were a little wrong about, it was how fast and how hard climate change was going to bite. Scientists, by their nature, are conservative. And so things have happened faster than we thought. Stuff that shouldn't be happening until the 2060s or 2070s or something like that is happening right now. And the damage is already enormous. So let's review the basics of the science and just where we are right now. So far, humans have raised the temperature of the Earth about 1 degree Celsius, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit. That doesn't sound like that's that much, you know. None of us can tell the difference between 60 degrees Fahrenheit and 58 if we walk outside in the afternoon. But the planet can tell. The extra heat that we trap per square meter of the Earth's surface is about, at the moment, 0.75 watts. Because we've burned coal and gas and oil and put all that CO2 in the air, and because its molecular structure traps heat, there's about an extra 0.75 watts per square meter of the Earth's surface. That is less than one of those white Christmas tree lights, little tiny ones, per square meter. So that doesn't sound like a lot, but there are a lot of square meters on planet Earth. And so the total is pretty astonishing. The heat equivalent, we trap each second the heat equivalent of about 4 Hiroshima-sized explosions. It's an extraordinary amount of heat, and it's been enough to melt most of the summer sea ice in the Arctic. Most of it, more than half of it's gone, and it appears that Greenland is now past the point of balance and in a kind of irreversible melt. It's been enough to kill off a vast portion of the world's coral reefs, and we think no matter what happens now, 90 to 99% of them will be gone by mid-century, a whole just corner of God's brain lobotomized. It's been enough, it's been enough to fundamentally, as you all know, disrupt the way that water moves around our planet. The basic physics of climate change, of heating, warm air holds more water vapor than cold. That means that you get more evaporation and hence more drought in arid areas. And at this point, we know what happens when we get drought, especially when it's accompanied by the kind of record heat that we're seeing. August saw the highest reliably recorded temperature ever measured on planet Earth, 130 degrees in the California desert. Probably more astonishing was what was happening on the California coast. San Luis Obispo, which is only a few miles from the vast Pacific, saw the temperature hit 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which is crazy. And so it should come as absolutely no surprise that 5 of the 10 biggest fires on record in California are currently burning. We passed the 4 million acre mark today for fire in California. And y'all are well aware of this because you've dealt with the smoke and because you've had plenty of fire in your own part of the world these last years. There's no mystery here. When it gets hot, things dry out really fast. And those of you who've worked fighting forest fires know that there's a series of tables about, you know, how quickly different, you know, how quickly grasses dry out and how quickly trees dry out and how quickly snags dry out and so on and so forth. And the numbers, when you start getting temperatures as high as we've gotten, just are scary. You all know that fire season lasts far longer across the West than it used to. And in those areas where it doesn't really snow, fire season's essentially year-round now. It's not just in the West. probably the most dangerous fires burning this year are in Siberia. Over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen massive fires, 3, 4, 5 degrees of latitude north of where we've ever seen fire before. But it's just gotten so hot that things dry out. And these always throw up big clouds of CO2. That's what burning wood does. But this year, there was pretty strong indications, A, that some of the fires had overwintered, that they came very early in the spring as soon as the snow melted, which makes one think that they've probably been burning in the duff all winter long. And they seem now to have definitively started burning into the peatlands that are so prominent around Siberia and that contain enormous storehouses of carbon. So what does this all lead us to think? Well, we've raised the temperature 1 degree, and that's caused the trouble that we've seen so far. If we do everything right at this point, it's possible that we could hold the rise in temperature below 2 degrees Celsius, but that would take doing everything right at this point. We're obviously not doing everything right at this point. Our country isn't even trying to join in the one international agreement on to do anything about climate change, the Paris Climate Accords. Think about that for a moment. The country in the world that put more carbon into the atmosphere than any other is the only country not even engaged in this global process. In fact, at the moment, on the kind of trajectory that the world is on, we're looking at 3 or 3.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature, 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And if that happens, we probably can't have civilizations anything like the ones that we're used to having. The move from 1 degree to a 2 degree world isn't going to be twice as bad as it is now. It's going to be exponentially worse because we're going past all these series of tipping points. And if you have any doubt of it, just look down at the Gulf of Mexico today. Hurricane Delta is bearing down, I guess appropriately, on the Mississippi Delta. It'll be there by later this week. Hurricane Delta, we're 4 letters now into the Greek alphabet because we've exhausted the Roman alphabet. We got through to the end of it. We're way ahead of where we've ever been in any year in history in terms of the number of storms. And that's just, you know, all I've really talked about is the 1.5% of the Earth's surface that's covered by the continental U.S. I mean, the same thing and worse is happening all over the planet. Africa's just come through the worst state of flooding it's almost ever experienced, because, of course, once that water's evaporated up in the atmosphere, it's going to come back down. The residence time of water vapor in the atmosphere is on average only about 7 days. So wet places get just endless gully washers and flooding. And so as a result, the damage already is enormous. The damage at 2 degrees is going to be like nothing we really have ever experienced. And beyond that, we move into truly impossible territory. So our job is to keep that from happening. Now, we have a kind of deadline. Science has finally sort of given us very hard numbers to work with. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in its last report in October of 2018, said that if we wanted to have some chance of meeting the targets that we'd set in Paris in 2015, that we would need a fundamental transformation of our energy systems by 2030. And they defined fundamental transformation of energy systems, helpfully, as reducing by about half the emissions that the world was pouring out. That sounds like an impossible job. And I have to tell you, it is on the bleeding edge of the possible. The reason that it's so hard, and I will just talk bluntly here for a minute, is because we have wasted 30 years doing nothing. There have been no congressional legislation on climate change, and much of the rest of the world has been as bad or worse. And why have we done nothing? Well, we know now. 5 or 6 years ago, great investigative reporters at places like Inside Climate News, the LA Times, the Columbia Journalism School, put together a series of exposés drawing on whistleblowers, on archives, on documents. And what they proved beyond any doubt was that the fossil fuel industry knew everything there was to know about climate change back in the 1980s. if you think about it, it makes complete sense. I mean, Exxon then was the largest company in the world, largest, richest company the world had ever seen. Great staff of scientists, and its product was carbon. So of course they were going to find out what was going on, and they did, and so did everybody else. Exxon's scientists, for instance, by the early 1980s, had given their executives a remarkably skillful prediction of where we would be. If you look at the numbers that they predicted in terms of temperature and CO2 concentration for 2020, they were uncannily accurate. They knew what was happening, and they were believed. Exxon, again, for instance, began building all their drilling rigs to compensate for the rise in sea level that they knew was in the offing. Did they tell the rest of us? No. The opposite. Once global warming became a public concern, 1988, when Jim Hansen testified before Congress, 1989, when I was writing, publishing my book, once those things happened, the fossil fuel industry instead hunkered down and began an expensive and powerful disinformation campaign. We now know that they hired many of the people who'd worked for the tobacco industry, indeed some that had worked for the DDT manufacturers back in Rachel Carson's day. And they went to work, and they were, by and large, successful. They managed to take what was clear scientific consensus and confuse people and make people doubt and so on. We went from a scenario where the Republican president of the United States in the late 1980s, George H.W. Bush, had promised to, in his words, fight the greenhouse effect with the White House effect, pretty good line. We went from that to the point where the current occupant of the White House labors under the misimpression that climate change is a hoax manufactured by the Chinese. Several hoaxes manufactured by the Chinese that we know about now. At any rate, what that did was prevent us from doing anything over those years. And as a result, the world produces far more carbon than it did in 1988, 1989. In fact, we've released more carbon in those 30 years than in all of human history before. The U.S. hasn't done much itself, even though it would be the easiest country, being the richest and with the most access to technology, to have changed really fast. Basically, at most, what we've done is close down some of our coal-fired generating capacity and replaced it with natural gas, which seemed at the time like a good idea, perhaps, or at least at the very beginning, because you produce about half as much carbon as you do with coal when you burn natural gas. Sadly, as some of us tried to point out along the way, if you release much methane unburned into the atmosphere, its molecular structure is an even more potent trapper of heat. And so America's total emissions haven't gone down at all. If anything, they've gone up, which is very depressing to think about. So that's the bad news about the situation that we're in. I wish I had better news to offer you. In fact, I kind of do, and I will offer it now. If we're going to make huge change in the decade to come, it's a good thing that we've spent the last decade preparing to make that change. And that preparation has come in two ways. The first has been the work of very able engineers and scientists. They've cut the cost of sun and wind power astonishingly. In the last decade, they've cut it 90%. There's been a technological learning curve unlike anything we've almost ever seen. And now batteries, happily, are on the same downward plummeting trajectory. That's extraordinarily good news. It's now the cheapest way to generate power around most of the world, including the United States, as those of you who live in places where wind power is becoming dominant know. That transition is underway. And indeed, this week we had the kind of interesting news that Exxon, which remember had been the richest company of any company in the world for many, many years, is now no longer not even the richest energy company. NextEra Energy, a big solar and wind provider, passed them in market capitalization 2 days ago. So that's a good sign. But if we let economics alone drive this transition, it will not happen anywhere near fast enough. Yes, 75 years from now, the world will run on sun and wind, but it will be a broken world that's running on sun and wind. The places that we truly love will be places that are burning, that are drought-ridden, that are underwater. All of it will be I don't even want to talk about it. The visions of the world, if we let things get out of control, are just too horrible. It'll be a broken planet. So the job is to make the transition happen much, much, much more quickly. And so the other half of the good news about the last 10 years is that while the scientists were doing their thing, at the same time, civil society, all of us, was starting to do our thing. And a movement has risen over that period. It's become one of the biggest movements, if not the biggest, in the planet's history, and it's beautiful to see. 350.org, which I helped found a decade ago, was a kind of first iteration, a beta test of whether or not they could be a global climate movement. Our first global day of action in 2009 had 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries, all 50 states. CNN called it the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. So it was a start. Most of those were small, 100 people here, 200 people there. It was a beginning, and you have to begin somewhere. But happily, others have also flooded in to do this work. Extinction Rebellion, the Sunrise Movement, Fridays for the Future with young people. You all know about Greta Thunberg, but there are 10,000 Greta Thunbergs in every corner of this planet, and they have millions of followers. Middle school and high school students are doing some of the best organizing on the planet around climate change. So that movement is learning how to erode the power of the fossil fuel industry, to stop it from being able to expand, indeed forcing it to begin to contract. You've seen some of the battles in that play out. Some of it began with the work over fossil fuel infrastructure. And the first big fight was the Keystone Pipeline, beginning in, 2011 was when we organized the first big demonstration in Washington. I wrote a letter asking people to come to D.C. and get arrested. And we didn't know how it would turn out, but it turned out well. It turned out to be the biggest civil disobedience action by anything in this country in many years. 1,200 and some people went to jail, and that jump-started this campaign against the Keystone Pipeline. And the good news, first piece of good news, is they still haven't built the Keystone Pipeline, though they're trying like hell to get it done while they've got their guy in the White House. The second piece of good news, more important, is that people watched that and saw that you could stand up to big oil. And now everything gets fought. Nothing gets built without a fight, not a coal port. You watched as people up and down the West Coast, especially Washington and Oregon, came together to quash plans for all six of those big coal ports that they had planned along the Pacific. And now there's really not much way out for that Powder River Basin coal, thank heaven. Their thin green line across the Pacific Northwest was enough to stymie an awful lot of that work, thank heaven. We fight every frack well, and we've seen state after state and country after country now block fracking. We fight every pipeline. You know that there are huge fights underway, not only about Keystone and Dakota Access, but Line 5 and Line 3 and dozens of others. And we win a surprising number of these fights. Moody's, the credit rating agency, put out a report 2 days ago telling people that they didn't think that it made sense to give good credit rating to natural gas pipeline companies, partly because activists had simply gotten too good at blocking them. And they had a kind of wall chart of all the pipelines that people have managed to shut down. So good work, those of you who've been engaged in any of those kind of fights. There have been other parts of this movement building that continue and that we need your help on. And an important one is the effort to stop what we call the money pipeline, the financial support that makes it possible for this rogue industry to keep doing what it's doing. The most visible of those fights for the last decade has been around fossil fuel divestment. A few of us decided some years ago that the oil companies really shouldn't be treated like normal companies. But if you looked at their business plans and you dug up all the oil and gas that they had in their reserves that they told their shareholders that they would burn, that if you did that, you got about five times as much carbon as any scientist thought it would be safe to burn. So we launched this fossil fuel divestment campaign, small at first, now very large, the largest effort of its kind in history. We've passed the $15 trillion mark for endowments and portfolios that have divested from fossil fuel. And this just continues to grow and grow and grow. Just in the last week, Cambridge University in England, the richest university in Europe, joined Oxford in divesting from fossil fuel. We've seen everybody from the University of California system to the city of New York's pension funds to the entire country of Ireland to much of the Catholic Church to on and on and on divest from fossil fuel, and it's been enormously helpful. Shell Oil said in their annual report last year that divestment had become a material risk to its business, which is good because Shell Oil's business is a material risk to the planet. So I'm going to end by saying we don't know whether we're going to win this fight or not, which is a very odd kind of point to be at. Most movements, you tell yourself, eventually we're going to win. It may take us 100 years. We'll keep coming back and get some more and more, but eventually people will have health insurance, or we will house the homeless, or eventually we'll solve some of our racial wounds or whatever it is. There's no eventually here. If we don't get it done really soon, we don't ever get it done. The possibility goes by forever, and with it, the world that we have known. So if you've been keeping your powder dry for some reason, the next 10 years is the last time probably when you're going to have really powerful leverage in order to make the changes that we need. So be thinking about what you can do in your own home. Yes, those things are very important. I'm proud of the fact that my house is covered with solar panels, but I don't try to fool myself that we're going to do this one Prius at a time, one vegan dinner at a time. Individual action is important, but really we're past the point mathematically where that's going to do it. The most important thing an individual can do is be less of an individual, is join together with others in these movements that can affect politics and economics at the root level and make real changes. And the most important of the, we can talk a lot about what all the changes that are possible, because we know interesting things now about sequestration of carbon in soils, about what forests do, about all sorts of things. The most important of those changes is to stop burning coal and oil and gas as fast as ever we can and replace them with, the miracle that is sun and wind power. That we live in a world where you can point a sheet of glass at the sun and out the back flows light and heat and information and all the other things that we need. That's a Hogwarts scale miracle. It's magic on a high order, and we should take advantage of it. I want to thank everybody who's done this work and thank everybody who's going to do it in the years going forward, because this is the challenge of our time. You can think of COVID as a kind of warm-up for it. And one of the things that it taught us, COVID, was that in the end, social solidarity really, really matters. We've spent a lot of time these last years trying to convince ourselves as a society that markets solve all problems, that we don't need governments. You know, Reagan's famous laugh line was, the nine scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. But that's not, the scariest words in the English language are either we've run out of ventilators or the hillside behind your house is on fire. Can't solve those, save by coming together and doing what needs to be done. So I salute all you who have done your best, and I will look forward to working shoulder to shoulder with y'all as we go forward on this. Many, many thanks.
Thank you, Bill. My name is Steve Charter. I'm a third generation Montana rancher, and the fourth and fifth generations live and work on our ranch near Shepherd, Montana. My parents were founding members of Northern Plains, and I have been an active member for over 40 years. Since we were introduced to holistic resource management almost 40 years ago, we have personally been working on ways to restore our arid rangelands and rebuild the soil to what it once was. Agriculture has been a big part of the problem with climate change, but it is also has great promise to be a big part of the solution. The work of the Northern Plains Soil Task Force is to lead the way in that transformation of agriculture. As we know, we must quit dumping more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but we must also address the legacy load of CO2 in the atmosphere, much of which came from the soil due to bad agricultural practices. The Northern Plains Soil Task Force believes we can reverse this process and return CO2 from the atmosphere, where it is causing big problems, back to being sequestered in the soil, where it will have great benefits. We also work in collaboration with groups across the country, bringing an agricultural voice and perspective to these conversations. We are leading by example. In 2017, we put on the Northern Plains Soil Summit, the first conference in the state to focus on regenerative practices. Since then, we have supported regenerative innovators and featured their work with field days showcasing the exciting potential and the tremendous benefits of soil health. We have also realized that, unfortunately, education and outreach aren't enough to bring about the changes needed to transform our present harmful system to a regenerative one. If we are to realize the scale of change that is needed, we must have major policy reform and have the avenues to help finance this transformation. That is why our second soil summit will have the top experts in the country exploring how we can reform federal and state policies to promote soil health and how we can finance this transformation. And now I'm going to turn it over to Joan Kresich to talk about the need and the process from transitioning from extractive industries to renewable energy and some opportunities already in motion along that front for Montana.
Hi, everyone. I'm Joni Kresich. I'm an active Northern Plains member. We at Northern Plains are committed to a clean and just energy future for Montana. Transitioning away from coal, oil, and gas, just as Bill has said, is so crucial to creating that future. No tar sands oil is sludging through the KXL pipeline this Monday evening. We've played a big role in that. In 2017, we sued TC Energy to stop pipeline construction. Even the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled against the KXL. These last years, with no KXL, hundreds of waterways have been spared a devastating oil spill. But the final chapter isn't written, and we're ready to continue the fight. We're creating the new clean energy economy all across Montana. We've launched solarized campaigns in towns and cities to raise awareness about the benefits of solar and get more arrays on homes. In Livingston, our library and other public buildings are using solar savings to support their missions and return benefits to the whole community. And we're just beginning. Northern Plains is rooted in democracy. And we put our democracy to work. Every legislative session, we show up to make sure bad bills die and good ones get the grassroots support they need. We'll be in Helena in 2021, making sure our clean energy bills get passed. We can see the day when true energy democracy is the rule, when our towns and cities own and control their energy sources, make all the decisions about that energy, and pocket the savings for community needs. We see that future, and we're working to make it reality. And now Bill's going to speak for a moment about the power of collective action and what it takes to build a movement.
Well, here's what it takes, I think, to make a movement, which is everybody working together and figuring out what it is that we have in common, not what takes us apart. In some ways, it's been a good year for that. Look, the most important quote of 2020 came from George Floyd as he was being murdered when he said, "I can't breathe." People can't breathe for lots of reasons. There's a cop kneeling on their neck, police brutality stifling their community. They can't breathe because they've got COVID, which be afraid of and take seriously in all the ways that we must. They can't breathe because there's a coal-fired power plant down the street, and one knows what neighborhoods those are most likely to be. They can't breathe because the wildfire smoke's gotten so intense that the authorities are telling people to go inside and tape shut their windows. People can't breathe because it's gotten too damn hot. We all need to breathe. And so we need to come together and build movements that in the end are about us breathing. And they've got to start with defending the people who are most vulnerable. The iron law of climate change is the less you did to cause it, the sooner you get hit. But now everybody's getting hit. So we got to get to work building that kind of movement, working together in all the ways that we can. And let me say, I think young people are actually showing the way and doing a good job. And it's time for older people to suck it up and do as well. And I know that they can. I was telling you about that letter I wrote asking people to come get arrested in D.C. at the start of the Keystone fight. I know there's people on this call tonight who answered that letter. And one of the things I said in it was, I did not think in that case that young people should have to be the cannon fodder. Because if you think about it, if you're 22, an arrest record might not be the best thing on your resume. But once you're past a certain point, what the hell are they going to do to you? Now, we did not ask people as they got arrested, how old are you? Because that would be rude. But we did ask them, cleverly, I thought, who was president when you were born? And the biggest number came from the FDR and the Truman administrations. So that was good. And a good sign now about what it is that we need to be doing. I'm just thinking about these issues as I watch the chat go by, and lots of people worried that wind and solar take materials to use and you're hard to recycle and on and on and on. And all that's true. There's no free lunch in any of this. But what we're talking about, if we don't get climate change under control, is the kind of ecological and geological transformation that we haven't seen for 70 million years or more on this planet since the last asteroid hit. We're talking about the extinction of half or more of the species on the planet. So we're going to need to do some things that are difficult. We're going to have to try and do them as cleanly and best as we can. But the basic notion is stop burning things. Stop burning coal and gas and oil and biomass, anything else that you set on fire, and start instead taking advantage of the very large nuclear reactor that's some millions of miles out in the sky, and using the power that it creates through the sun and the wind in order to make the change that we need to make. And we can do that, but it's going to take people pushing harder than we've pushed to date. Maybe the pushing will get a little easier after November 3rd. We will see. But the need to do it will not go away.
Thank you, Bill. I was one of the people who received your letter and was moved enough to make it to DC. So thank you for that. We in Northern Plains are working hard toward a future where we live in harmony with nature, where our economy serves the people rather than the people serving the economy, where neighbors work side by side to build a world that lives up to our ideals of fairness, inclusion, and justice. Here in Livingston, we use Bill's words: the best thing an individual can do for the climate is to stop being an individual. We hope you'll join forces with us by becoming a member this evening. As we bring ourselves into the Northern Plains community, each of us contributes our collection of skills and talents. Together, we make a sturdy mosaic, a sort of human ecosystem where each person supports our group efforts and the group supports each person's contribution. That's when our Northern Plains ecosystem of activism is ready to support that other immense ecosystem, the one all life on Earth depends on. Becoming a member means that you'll join the power of Northern Plains to fight for environmental justice. You'll be able to get involved in our campaigns, elect leaders, serve as a leader yourself if you want, help choose what we work on and how we work on it, and access trainings and resources. So to become a member, go to northernplains.org to the upper right-hand corner and click on Join. We welcome you.
We are now going to enter the Q&A portion of this event. So we'll be asking Bill some questions from the audience at this time. Bill, the first question is from Rudy Molinek of Madison, Wisconsin, who asks, as a climate scientist, how can I help society turn the corner and avoid despair? Which is echoed by Maria Grathwall of Billings, Montana, who wants to know, how do we stay energized for the long haul?
Well, those are good questions, and I'm the right person to ask them to, because I've definitely been around for the long haul. You can tell with one glance in my direction. Look, it's hard because some of this is depressing and hard, but here are the reasons that I keep going, and I think, and I know that you all do too. First thing, there really is a movement building, and that is a wonderful thing to watch. I feel far better about this than I did 10 years ago because I know that we're going to have this fight now. I don't know we're going to win it, but I know we're going to have it. And we didn't know that a decade ago. People are lining up and they're doing their part. Second thing, a lot of those people are doing it from places that did not cause this problem. Let's be frank. Most people in the world have not caused the planet to overheat. The top 1% of richest people in the world have produce more carbon than the bottom half of all the people on the planet. Those of us who lived in North America have done way more than our share. And if the good people in Bangladesh and Fiji and wherever can get in this fight, then we can too. Third thing is, like most of you, I get to live in a beautiful place where I'm reminded daily of what the stakes are and where I'm able to go out into that world and be renewed by it and comforted by it. And I think there is no question that everybody should do their best to get out into that world at least some of the time. I always had over my computer a quote from Ed Abbey, my old friend, that said, you should be a halftime activist and spend the rest of your time, if you can, out wandering around with the grizzlies and the rivers full of fish and whatever else. And so make sure you do. If for no other reason, then even if we do everything right, the world's not going to get any better than it is right now. And one of the jobs of human beings is to pay witness to all that beauty and pay witness right now in this season to the passage into winter and those dark nights starting to come and the temperature starting to fall. And it won't be long before the snow has begun to fall up at West Yellowstone and the world's beginning to transform again for another season. So enjoy every second of it, even as we're doing the work to make sure that those that come after us get that same kind of beauty and pleasure.
Thanks, Bill. The second question is from Diana Hammer of Helena, Montana. What are some of the most effective ways you found to move people to take action and support significant climate action?
So the problem with climate change, and what a good question that is, the problem with climate change is it seems incredibly big and we seem incredibly small next to it. And so it's hard to feel a sense of sufficient, I think what the social scientists call agency, a sense that you're actually going to be able to affect the outcome here. And really, that intuition is in many ways correct. As I was saying earlier, we all should do the things we can in our homes, absolutely for sure. But you also know when you're screwing in the new LED light bulb, that good idea though it is on many fronts, it's probably not going to be the thing that stops climate change. And so what we need to do is figure out how to come together. Now, we're not so good at that anymore, you know? We've spent the last 50, 75 years being trained to think of ourselves mostly as consumers, identify ourselves as consumers. Most Americans don't know their next door neighbors, okay? It's less true in rural areas, but even there, things have changed over the years, you know? And so learning how to be a citizen again is a really important part of this. Learning how to do things together in ways that make change happen. You don't need me to tell you that our system is kind of set up at the moment especially in Washington, but even in the states, to prevent things from happening. And that's how the powers that be, you know, the Koch brothers or whoever it is, that's how they like it, because frankly, they're quite happy with the world as it is right now. And if we're going to change it, we need to figure out the ways for the small and the many to be able to stand up to the mighty and the few. That's what nonviolent movement building is about. And that's why it's so important to see wonderful people emerge onto the scene like Greta Thunberg and just remind us of what we're capable of.
Here's another one, Bill. How do we change the narrative on climate change? Are there any types of media or approaches you find especially effective?
Well, here's the good news. I think this is a battle we've more or less won. The polling data over the last few years has been remarkable. We're at 70% of Americans now who understand more or less what the problem is and how it works. They may not all get the urgency of it, but they get the basic outline. And to get 70% of Americans agreeing about anything at this point is fairly remarkable. The numbers are even higher when we ask people, should the government be doing more to promote solar energy? It's the single most popular thing in the country. And 80% of Republicans and Democrats and independents say, yes, get to work on this now. The reasons that we're reaching that kind of consensus have to do partly with the movement building I've described, and more to do with the fact that Mother Nature is a powerful educator. And the second or third or fourth summer in a row, when they're telling you you shouldn't go out for a hike because the wildfire smoke's gotten too thick to safely breathe, I mean, at a certain point, who are you going to believe? Fox News or your own lying eyes, you know? And so that's helping to change things in a profound way. The question now is not about converting the last 30% of people into believing this, because most of them aren't. Their opposition is ideological. One more study in science or nature isn't going to next week convince them to think differently. The real challenge is getting some significant portion of that 70% actively engaged in the fight. And that's why what Northern Plains is doing is so important. It's why we set up groups like 350. It's what the Sierra Club's about. It's why on and on and on, so that we can get people actively involved in these fights in powerful ways. And I will add, if you do have people who you're still trying to convince and change this narrative about, sometimes you can do it. And there are several avenues to think about. If you know people for whom the military is an important point of reference, point out that the Pentagon is the one place in Washington that stayed fully focused on climate change because they understand the threat it poses. If you know people who are religious in nature, point out that most of our churches and denominations are actively engaged in this fight, and the greatest climate fighter on the planet may be Pope Francis, whose encyclical on global warming, Laudato Si, is one of the most remarkable documents of the millennium. And then the other set of people that we should just be trying to engage as hard as we can are people who love the outdoors, because there's plenty of people who hike and ski and hunt and fish and really aren't doing what they need to do to protect those places. And that's why it's so good to see groups emerging like Protect Our Winters, say, that really focus on taking those user groups. And I will say, there are more of those people now than there used to be. I assume this is happening where you are too. Where we are in this COVID time, every trailhead is crowded every weekend. Everybody's out there. I got to say, I'm not the only person who managed to screw up themselves in a bike accident in the course of this year. There's people falling all over the place, okay? And those are people that we need in these fights in a big way.
Thanks, Bill. I think this is going to be our last question for the evening. Several people have been wondering, are there two to three specific or particularly innovative policy measures that you think should be at the forefront of our efforts?
Well, most of the policy work, most of this stuff, there's no huge secrets here. The basic task is to replace with renewable energy, fossil energy, as fast as is humanly possible. The early stuff in, say, a Biden administration will look like the things you can do by executive action. And it'll involve things like he's already pledged to stop new oil and gas development on public lands in the U.S. which is a big deal, not only to people who would prefer not to have their public lands filled with gas wells, but also because the public lands in the U.S. are the fifth biggest carbon source in the whole world. The things outlined in the Green New Deal make a great deal of sense. Look, A, we're in a huge hole climatically, and B, we're now in a huge hole economically. We have unemployment of a sort of scale we haven't seen since the Great Depression. So it's no wonder that a new deal is appealing to people, you know? So those are the kind of policy things, but they're also new and interesting scientific ideas that are coming to the fore. Steve was talking about some of that work that y'all are doing around carbon sequestration, and it's really exciting. We know a lot more about soil than we used to, and we know that if you manage it properly, it can be a way to draw down carbon from the atmosphere. Think of it this way. The job of cutting off coal and oil and gas is a way to kind of stop pouring more water into the bathtub. And the kind of work that Steve is describing is sort of making the hole at the drain at the bottom of the bathtub bigger so that what's already up there drains a little faster. Now, it's not easy work. You know, the advantage of targeting oil companies are hard to take on because they're rich and powerful, but there's only a dozen of them. It's a manageable target set. There's a billion farmers on planet Earth, so it's not easy to change cultures and things quickly and overnight. And the next farm bill, for instance, will be a big deal when it comes to trying to make some progress on that. But these are exciting things. They're reminders that if we figure out how to take a step back to use less of the world and to treat it better, that there's still some chance of it meeting us halfway. I'll just end by saying, we've got to be cognizant of how fast we have to go here, because if we don't make the big changes that we have to make over the next 10 years, we're going to get past the point where any kind of rescue mission is possible. Things are going to go into such a state that we won't be able to pull this one out of the literal fire. So the work is to be done over the next decade, I think. And on the one hand, that's a burden. But on the other hand, it's kind of a privilege for all of us to get to be able to do the most important thing that humans have gotten to do, to be the people who do that. And, you know, people have faced other great challenges. Our parents and grandparents had to go to Europe to fight fascism. You know, they had to cross the ocean and kill or be killed. And we don't have to do that. We have a different set of tasks that aren't as bloody, but they are demand the same kind of commitment. And that's why I'm so grateful to y'all for being part of that network that's emerged around the world. And it really is a help to all of us to know that each other are out there. Be aware that people in low-lying Pacific Islands are grateful that people on the high plains are taking this problem seriously. Be grateful that people in the high Andes are thinking along the same lines that you are, or in the low-lying parts of the low countries in Europe or wherever it is. Together, we have some shot at doing what needs doing. Some of that work has to be done locally, and some of it has to be done in connection with everybody else around the world. So it's a great pleasure for me tonight to get to be a small part of that connecting out process to the rest of the planet, and just to be able to offer thanks on behalf of people I know all over the world for the work that you guys are doing. And I will look forward to the day when this pandemic is past, and it'll be a pleasure to get out there and see y'all and go for a ski deep into some beautiful wood someplace with y'all, because you represent one of the most important and beautiful places on the entire planet. And thank you for taking care of it.
Thank you so much, Bill. We really appreciate the time you spent with us.
Thank you, Bill.
Good night, y'all.
We look forward to having you back again in Montana after COVID to come and ski with us. That was our program for tonight.
You have just heard a conversation with ecologist, author, activist Bill McKibben via Zoom on October 5th, 2020. It was hosted by the Northern Plains Resource Council. You can find out more about NPRC and their work by going to northernplains.org. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LaClaire for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.